Okay. Well, continuing in our study of the English Civil War and trying to wrestle through the dynamics of these issues that were grappled with at that time. And we ended last time with the execution of King Charles I. He was executed on January the 30th, 1649, executed for treason. They found in the court they'd set up him to have declared war upon his own people and been involved in ordering their deaths. And so they judged him and executed him. So 30th of January 1649, Charles is executed. On the 5th of February, not very long afterwards, the Scottish Parliament proclaims Charles II King of Scotland. He was in Holland still, but they declared he was the king. In fact, they, you know, went so far as to say he's the king of the whole of Britain. And so these Presbyterians declared him to be king. When the king was executed, Charles I, England declared themselves a republic, a commonwealth, as their form of government. And they passed a proclamation to say that Charles II, it would be treason to declare him king. So Scotland defied that and declared Charles II king. Ireland immediately was a problem because you had a lot of royalists have fled to Ireland. They still supported the king, and there was a substantial military force that was pulled together in Ireland. And you had the royalists joining together, you had English Catholics, you had native Irish Catholics, also in alliance with the Ulster Catholic Army. So you had this whole grouping, and they were all very anti what was happening in England, very pro the king, and so there was an immediate threat from Ireland. And so the English Council, the Council of State, said we have to do a preemptive strike against these guys, otherwise our whole structure here is going to be destroyed. And so they asked Cromwell to deal with this Irish rebellion. So Cromwell set out pretty soon for Ireland and gave commands to his forces to say, you're not allowed to raid. We're going to treat civilians in an honorable way. We're not going to steal and plunder the people. We're not going to do anything like that. We are serving God and his kingdom. And on his way into Ireland, two of his soldiers raided a farmer's chicken house and stole chickens from them. And he had his two guys executed. He said, this is lawless. This is mutiny. And so they were executed. On September the 3rd, this becomes a very interesting date in Cromwell's life. September the 3rd. We'll see it appearing a few times after this. But on September the 3rd, he arrived at the city of Drogheda. I don't know exactly how you pronounce that. It's got the H in there somehow. Drogheda. So that's how I'm going to pronounce it. And the city was surrounded by Cromwell, and he sent the governor of the city an ultimatum. Surrender to the end that the effusion of blood may be prevented. Let's not spill unnecessary blood. So surrender. Now, the Irish plan was to delay Cromwell's advance to Ireland, and this city had been fortified, Drogheda, and the goal and the plan and the strategy was a long, drawn-out siege. They wanted Cromwell to have to be stuck here in Drogheda for a long time. With the onset of winter coming in, the lack of food, the coldness, sickness will decimate his army, and that would do the most damage to Cromwell's army. So they wanted a drawn-out campaign. And so the city was under the command of Sir Aston. He refused to surrender. But he knew exactly what he was doing in refusing to surrender, as did the supreme commander of this Irish army, who wasn't in the city, but his tactics were, this were his tactics, and he knew what it meant to refuse the surrender offer. What it would mean would be that if Cromwell defeated the city, all the armed men would be executed. These were the accepted terms of war of the day. That's how it happened. And you can see a certain amount of wisdom and thinking when you're conquering a whole nation and you've got these different cities, that it makes sense across the board. Cromwell breached the walls of the city in not too long a time and proceeded, on that day that he breached it, I think they killed 2,000 men. No civilians were targeted. The next day, Cromwell killed all the officers that were captured, and 1 in 10 of the soldiers were killed. He didn't kill every soldier, but he killed 1 in 10 of the soldiers that were left. And Robertson says, however fashionable it may be to accuse Cromwell of a war crime in Drogheda, he stuck precisely to the rules of war as they were well understood by Aston and by Ormonde. Ormonde was the supreme commander of the Irish forces. And these two commanders gambled their men's lives on a strategy of no surrender that failed. That was their strategy. No surrender, delay the tactics, we'll defeat Cromwell by just attrition, wearing him out. But Cromwell did this to prevent bloodshed on both sides, because he's sending a message to the rest of the country where he's moving on to and saying that he means business. Many accusations of cruelty and barbarity are flung at Cromwell for this war, but real evidence is really lacking. And I'll bring to your attention a book called Cromwell, An Honorable Enemy, written by Tom Riley. And that's a book by this Irishman who went to investigate the evidence that there is for all these atrocities that Cromwell is accused of. So he's coming from an Irish perspective. He's coming from the Roman Catholic perspective. So that's where his sympathies are. And he ends up writing a book with that title, An Honorable Enemy. And he failed to find evidence to substantiate these gross atrocities that Cromwell apparently committed. And when you're reading Cromwell's writings and his letters and stuff, the whole time you're just being bathed with the godliness of his position and his desire for seeking God and doing God's will. D'Aubigné has a book called The Protector. It's on Cromwell's life, and most of the book is just Cromwell's writings. It's letters and stuff that he's written back and forth, and, you know, with the dates on when he wrote them and where he was at and what campaign he was doing. And you just get this overwhelming sense of his devotion to do God's will. And he never forgot about why he was engaged in this. It was about the people. He wanted reformation of the laws in England. He wanted there to be true justice and true liberty and a whole reformation of the legal system. However, now with the campaign in Ireland not yet over, Cromwell was called back to London in May of 1650 because there had been a serious development in Scotland. Negotiations between the Scottish and Charles II had progressed significantly, and Charles basically was on his way back to Scotland to be crowned king. That's what was going on. They were crowning him the king of Scotland, Ireland, and England. And Robertson says Charles had agreed to the Solemn League and Covenant in principle, pretending to bind himself to Presbyterianism forever. So he had said, yes, I agree. The Covenanters jumped at this. All the Presbyterians said, this is great. He's agreed to that. Let's bring him back and do this. So Scotland had agreed to invade England and restore the monarchy in return for the monarch's promise to impose Presbyterianism by force of law. To sweeten this pill, Charles announced a general amnesty for all who had fought or judged his father, with only 3 exceptions. Cromwell, Bradshaw, who was the main judge in the court, and John Cook, the prosecutor. So those were the only 3. He said, I will not give amnesty to those 3. Robertson says that Cromwell begged, this is Robertson's words, Cromwell begged the bigoted Kirkmen as he marched north, but they were constipated by their solemn covenant and undismayed by the coming of war. The covenant, the Solemn League and Covenant was kind of stuck in them. They couldn't get out of it. They couldn't think beyond it. They couldn't see through the issue of what this despicable person they were coming back, what they were bringing back, the oppression that was going to follow him. They couldn't see that. They had this idea of Presbyterianism trumped everything else. And if they could just get his agreement to Presbyterianism, everything else fell away. Cromwell marched into Scotland with his sights set on Edinburgh. The Scots had prepared. Edinburgh is quite close to the northern border of England. So he marched through there. But the Scots had decimated and removed any kind of thing that could be eaten. All livestock was taken out. Crops were all removed. There was nothing for the English to fend off the land. And so the supply route was a little bit precarious for the English to get supplied. And so with poor food, and the weather was particularly cold that year, so the cold weather, lots of rain, a lot of Cromwell's army were sick and weak. Around August, Cromwell wrote to the church leaders in Scotland. He didn't want to fight his brethren. And he appealed to them, "Brethren, can't you see what's going on here?" And he assured them, saying, "It being no part of our business to hinder any of the honest people of Scotland from worshipping God in that way they are satisfied in their consciences by the word of God they ought. Though different from us. We're not intending. We don't want to do that. We have no intention. We have no desire. We have absolutely nothing wanting to impose upon you, unlike what the Scottish wanted to impose on the English." Cromwell wanted to know how, under the pretense of the covenant, a king should be taken in by you to be imposed upon us, and this be called the cause of God and the kingdom. A king who, at this very instant, has a popish army fighting for and under him in Ireland. The battle was still continuing in Ireland. So he's got this army, which was a popish army, fighting in Ireland. He has Prince Rupert, a man who has had his hand deep in the blood of many innocent men of England, now at the head of ships stolen from us. He has the French and Irish ships daily making depredations, attacks on our coasts. This is what he's doing. His allies are doing this. And the godly interests you pretend you have received upon him, we cannot discern. How do you interpret this as godly interests? And we've received the king upon the grounds of godly interests. He's writing to the church leaders. Cromwell continued asking how they, joining with Charles and all the known corruption associated with him, how this should be for the security and satisfaction of God's people in both nations, or how the opposing of this should render us enemies to the godly with you. We cannot understand. How can us opposing you, enforcing the king down our throats, how can that find fault with the godly in your midst? That was taken some of the excerpts from D'Aubigné. He wrote this on August the 14th, 1650. Toward the end of August, Cromwell withdrew to Dunbar. He was struggling to break through with Edinburgh. The defenses were immense, and he would have just lost a tremendous amount of forces. So he withdrew to Dunbar. His army was a lot of sick folk and weak, and it was very cold. The Scottish army now pursued him and cut off his path south. So Dunbar is kind of on the coast. There's water around him here like that. On his north and on his east. South is the road and escape. There's a mountain and the ocean, and the road goes in between that. And the Scottish army has possessed that high ground and cut off his retreat. So he's trapped now. And they're in an unassailable position on the mountains and the ridges. It's too high and they're too strong. And he's just standing there saying, "Lord, now what?" He said, "Only a miracle is going to help us. We're in a very precarious situation." Some have said the church leaders were forcing the commander. I'm not sure. I think there's confusion there. I don't know where that story originated. But I think the Scottish commander, and he was a guy who fought with Cromwell back in the previous war against the Royalists, but now he was a brilliant general as well. I think he perceived this is the time we can crush the English. And so he moved his forces down the hill on the 2nd of September. They were on the other side of this river. It was a bridge and a road that crossed it to the east. Cromwell's forces were backed by the city of Dunbar. And he moved his forces down. One thing in their mind in the morning, we attack. And as the famous from the Patriot, it ends today from Cornwallis, was basically the mindset of the Scottish forces as they lined up, came down that on the 2nd, spent the night in the forest. It was a horrendous night, rain and cold and wind. It was just terrible. And a lot of the Scottish officers withdrew to find shelter in farmhouses where they could get a nice meal and get some rest for the great day in the morning. So the Scottish had superior numbers and were still blocking off the southern route. So they were assured of their victory over the small, cold, hungry, sickly army. As Cromwell watched the Scottish move their forces down into position, he saw the miracle. He had said, "We need a miracle." As they moved into position, his military eye in his mind, he said, "There's the miracle." And he saw, he had been handed this miracle. And this miracle was not a way to escape back to England. This miracle was, "I am going to defeat the Scottish army." And he saw it in his mind. The Scottish center is lined up opposite them. The center and the left flank couldn't maneuver. You see, with them thinking, coming down the mountain, behind them was the mountain, in front of them was this river. They were not thinking about maneuvering. They were just going to be flowing across and conquering. They weren't thinking about anything but victory the next day and attacking Cromwell's army, forces. They could not maneuver. Cromwell immediately saw that. And so under the cover of rain and dark and wind, he moved his forces all up behind each other onto the road and was going to attack their right flank, which was mainly cavalry. So he was going to throw everything he had at the cavalry and the right flank. And his timing was impeccable and his movement was amazing. And just wave after wave, he attacked them up and he broke through. And they turned and started to flee. And the only way they could flee was into their own forces, who couldn't maneuver. They had no way to swing around. They had no way to swing around or send in a counter. They were trapped between the river and the mountainside. And there was no way to maneuver, a military force. And their cavalry is charging into them, being chased by the English. And they just panicked. They dropped their weapons and they started running. This mighty Scottish army. And so they were being chased. Apparently at this point, as the Scottish dropped their weapons and started running, Cromwell's forces stopped and sang Psalm 117 and then continued. And so they sang that, and then they chased them down. They chased them for 8 miles, just killing people and capturing them. And some 3,000 Scottish soldiers were killed. And you'll get different numbers from different people, but and 6,000 to 10,000 were captured, along with cannons, ammunition, supplies. It was a huge gathering of equipment and stuff that fell into Cromwell's lap here. Some say that they were the wounded prisoners were just sent home. They said, "You can crawl home, go home, however you want to get home, you can." And the rest who weren't wounded, they were marched. Cromwell was getting them out of Scotland. He marched them back to England. Unfortunately, it was a very treacherous and long and grueling march, and many died on the way, and more died in captivity when they were back in England. But they were sent back. Cromwell marched on to Edinburgh and basically took the city with some ease, because they'd heard what had happened at Dunbar. The Scottish army was decimated in tatters. Some of the top commander of the Scottish army, he had fled. He wasn't captured. He had fled north to Stirling, I believe it was, and was trying to regroup there. The king was up in Stirling and kind of unfurled his banners up there. Others moved into the west of Scotland and tried to regroup and stuff. So Cromwell had taken Edinburgh and then was working on dealing with, you know, continuing his campaign in that area. But as Cromwell got that decisive battle at Dunbar, when he won that amazing battle, he immediately wrote to Parliament, took no glory for himself, and said, "This was God. He gave us this incredible gift." And you guys get on with the work of reforming the laws of England. The people need good laws. Get to work. The Rump Parliament was not very efficient at the moment in doing the things that they needed to be doing. So, like I said, Cromwell remained in Scotland, and the Scottish commanders had regrouped in the north and the west. So that was the end of 1650. 1st of January 1651, the official coronation of the king took place. Okay, so he's officially crowned, and this stalwart covenanter Presbyterian is the guy actually placed the crown on the king's head, and the sermon was preached, and it was a great occasion. And in the book Sketches of the Covenanters, this is a pro-Scottish covenanter book, it's, you know, it's on their side. So in this book, we are told about the king's coronation, and we read, "The solemn league and covenant was read. He, Charles II, gave his assent to it with an overflow of vehemence. Then Charles said, 'By the eternal and almighty God, who liveth and reigneth forever, I shall observe and keep all that is contained in this oath. I will have no enemies but the enemies of the covenant. No friends, but the friends of the covenant.'" The book continues, "The English Parliament, after the execution of Charles I, had passed an act making it treason to proclaim this prince king. The Covenanters, having thus elevated Charles to the throne, must now settle accounts with England on the battlefield." So this book is saying, no, this was good what the Covenanters did. They made him king, and now they've got to get to the work of settling the king. Now, this king, he had absolutely no intention of keeping this. He had no intention. He was just like his father, if not worse, with respect to just making promises so that he could get his advantage. All he was trying to do was gain the throne of the empire. And the first step was to be king of Scotland, have the Scottish backing, take England, and Ireland was kind of half in his hand already. Okay, so this was in January that he's proclaimed king. Cromwell fell extremely ill in February, and that continued for quite some time. He was only well enough to write to his wife in April. Again in May he fell sick again.